morning, and welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. I hope you all enjoyed your extra hour of sleep last night. My name is Mike Grell. I am this morning's representative from the board. We have a variety of announcements about church life and activities. Please read the announcements listed in your order of service, and be sure to take the order of service home with you to read them in greater detail. In addition, there are a few other announcements. We're going to start with Amy, who would like to make an announcement about the Time, Treasure, and Talents conclusion.
Good morning. Our annual Time, Talent, and Treasure silent auction came to an end last Sunday, and with winning bids ranging anywhere from $2 up to $200, our grand total was $6,650. So, congratulations. Kevin and I will be in the social hall after the service. You can pick up any treasures that you want. You can make a payment. Any questions you have at all, just come see us. So, thank you to everyone who made a donation or many donations, and thank you to all of the winning bidders. Either way, your generosity is greatly appreciated.
Thanks, Amy. LCUUC is sponsoring a bag, a blanket, and a bear this holiday season to benefit children in the foster care system. If you'd like to help, please read the announcement about it in the order of service and take a tag off the tree. The Ministerial Search Committee would like to have a listening session with the middle school and high school youth today to learn what is important to them and a potential minister. They will meet with the youth from 11:15 to 11:30 in their classrooms. A reminder, a sign-up sheet for Jim's book discussion group is on the welcome table in the foyer. The book to be discussed is A House of Hope, The Promise of Progressive Religion for the 21st Century. The discussions run for 7 Sundays from January 6th through April 7th. Thanksgiving potluck is November 18th. Barb Adams is going to be coordinating it and is in need of 2 volunteer coordinators. It is a very short window this Sunday and next Sunday. Barb has sign-up sheets. See her in the social hall after the service. We had 140 people last year. Let's make it another great event. This Sunday, because Jim is here, he will be meeting with a few members after service with our and any visitors that wish to join him after the service in his office. We'd like to get to know you and answer any questions you may have. We'll meet, as I mentioned, in the minister's office after. Grab a cup of coffee and meet you there. Also, if you're a first-time visitor, we want to let you know that the topics and sermons presented here vary each week, both in content and with different speakers. We embrace diversity here, so remember that we affirm and promote the 7 principles, we are not a dogma-based religion. Your experience and the message each week will change. I invite you to greet those sitting around you.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Jim. If you are visiting us today, we particularly welcome you. Please sign the guest ledger in the visitor's table in the foyer. There's a variety of information available on that table about our church and Unitarian Universalism. Help yourself to anything that interests you. I will be in the social hall after the service, although I just said I'll be in Jim's office, so I lied. If you are visiting us with your children, it is our custom for the children to remain with us until after the story of all ages, at which time they go to their religious education classes. Your child is welcome to join them or remain in service with you. If you would like to go along and observe your child's class, please do so. The nursery is just out the doors to my right, across the entryway, if there's a need for childcare. Classes will end at 11:15, although today there's discussion about the future minister, and you can pick your child up then at 11:30. We always enjoy getting to know our guests. If any members have brought guests today, we'd be pleased if you would introduce them. If any guests have brought themselves and feel comfortable introducing themselves, this would be a good time to do so. We always enjoy getting to know you. Everyone is invited to gather in the social hall after the service for refreshments and conversation. The conversation corner is a good place to gather for further discussion of the service. Please put your cell phones on silence mode. I hope you find this morning's service enlightening. Our speaker today is Jim.
The grace of life and the disgrace of life abound, lying within each of our lives and in the life of the world. We know not why, but life is visited by great grifts and great distress. As we gather together, each of us brings into our beloved community common human experience. Our joy and pain, the joy and pain of the world. Sunday by Sunday, we light our chalice as we come together. The flaming chalice serves as a shared reminder, a reminder that all life falls within the compass of our religious concern. All life falls within our personal responses and our community responses. Our responses of compassion and care, our work for justice and peace. Our concern and our responses are gifts of gratitude offered in appreciation for life together, appreciation for our loving companions in life's ongoing journey. And it is in this spirit this morning that we light our chalice. I now invite you to rise in body or in spirit for our opening hymn, Life of Ages. We will sing stanzas 1, 3, and 5.
Now is the time for the story for all ages, so if the children could come up and join us and have a seat down in front. I'm going to read the story today, and Eric's going to help me, and Abby's going to help as well. So come on down. Here's all our kids. Thanks for coming down. Okay, so I'm going to read a story today called Olympia Brown, A Voice and a Vote. Because we all know what's coming up this week, right, in terms of voting. So this is a story about voting from a pretty long time ago. So, and Abby is going to be our Olympia Brown. Okay. When Olympia Brown was little, girls weren't supposed to whistle. Girls weren't supposed to climb trees or run fast or catch frogs. But Olympia did. She did all those things. All those things and more. Her father told her,
Olympia, you can do whatever a boy can do.
And Olympia knew it was true. She climbed trees and ran fast and caught frogs. And when she was in school, she answered the teacher's questions loud and clear. One lady in town said,
Little girls ought to be quiet. They ought not to make themselves heard.
But Olympia did. She had a voice, and she was going to use it every day. When Olympia Brown was a teenager, young women weren't supposed to go off to college. Young women weren't supposed to leave home to go off and learn complicated things. But Olympia did. She did all those things and more. Olympia left home and went to college. She went to class. And she studied. And she learned all kinds of complicated things. One professor at her school said,
Young women ought not to be in college. But since they are here, they must read their reports. Young women can't give speeches from memory like the men.
But Olympia did. When it was her turn to present her report, she rolled up the papers in her hand and said each and every word loud and clear. Olympia Brown had a voice, and she was going to use it every day. When Olympia Brown was in college, women weren't supposed to wear pants. Women were supposed to wear very long dresses that came all the way down to their toes. But Olympia did. She wore dresses that came down only past her knees, and under them she dared to wear pants. Bloomers, the pants were called, after Amelia Bloomer, the woman who had created them a few years before. One of the men said,
Women ought not show their ankles in public, and women certainly ought not to wear pants.
But Olympia did. She wore her bloomers every day, no matter how much the men sneered. When Olympia was finished with college, women weren't supposed to be ministers. Women never stood up in front of a congregation and talked about God. But Olympia did. She did all those things and more. She graduated from theological school in 1863 and was ordained as a Universalist minister in June of that year, the second woman to ever be officially ordained by that church. She became the Reverend Olympia Brown. A minister said,
Women ought not to speak in public, and women ought not take the pulpit or discuss the nature of God.
But the Reverend Olympia Brown did. During the next 35 years, she was a minister in 5 different congregations, including a church in Wisconsin that's named after her. And she visited other congregations, too. She took the pulpit in every single one, and she spoke on the nature of God and love, and she did an excellent job. Olympia Brown had a voice, and she used it every day. When Olympia Brown was born, women weren't allowed to vote. Women weren't allowed to have any say in who was elected president or senator or mayor of the town. But Olympia had something to say about that. She had a lot to say about that. She traveled all over the state of Kansas in a horse and buggy, giving speeches. She gave speeches to convince people that women deserved the right to vote. She wrote hundreds of letters. She spoke to the representatives and senators in Congress. She marched in parades. She and her friends worked hard to get women the right to vote. Olympia had a voice. She used it every day for over 50 years. And finally, when Olympia Brown was old, women were given the right to vote. In November of 1920, when Olympia was 85 years old, she voted for the first time. Olympia always had a voice, and she'd used it to make sure that she and all the other women in the United States had a vote as well. And that's our story. So thanks for listening. So now, Jade, can you come up and get the lantern? And we'll have you guys wait till Jade gets the lantern, and then the kids will follow her out and go to RE. And the congregation is going to sing Go Now in Peace.
The kids are gone. Now we can really talk. I'm kidding. Just thought that would be a funny way to start as opposed to how I usually start, which is to say, hi, I'm Susan Atkinson, and I'm new. I was born and raised in the South, where we are known for having colorful and persuasive preachers. In my family, we do have two preachers on my father's side, two and three generations back. The old man was a Methodist circuit rider who served far-flung, fledgling congregations states away. He would ride from Delaware for days and weeks and hold fire and brimstone revivals wherever he could get folks to gather. His son took after him. That makes my great and great-great grandfather's preacher's kids. So you can imagine that by the time my dad was growing up, religion was not at all emphasized in the home. And in raising the six of us, my parents seemed very concerned with not declaring anything too emphatically, confronting anybody, or even being near anyone who might be confronting somebody. They became Episcopalians. And as many stories have unfolded, my parents ended up raising kids with very emphatic ideas about how the world should work. I won't go through the list of which of my siblings and cousins ended up where on the religio-political spectrum. But over the years, our family gatherings have often, and I mean often, turned into, well, theological death matches. Over time, it was a long, long civil war. It was not until I was nearly 30 that I first got to know an amazing, life-changing preacher. Rex Caney is a quiet man who naturally and seemingly with ease lives the way we all want to live. He is a gifted storyteller whose spirit is palpably invigorated when he's in the pulpit. Out of the pulpit, he has time for everyone and makes you feel like your concerns and perspective are foremost in his mind. When running meetings, he infuses humor and insight into the proceedings while allowing members to take ownership of the church. His easygoing manner makes new people feel welcome. He cares deeply about the homeless population in Atlanta, the city which is home to the beautiful Antebellum Methodist Church where I met Rex. It is a nearly 200-year-old building in the heart of the city in which Sherman spared little else. Rex was even good at space planning and building maintenance. He helped convert the basement of the church into a shelter for 15 men, complete with necessary support services to help them get their lives back on track. We added a soup kitchen operated each week by a different visiting church, which served over 400 meals each Sunday. Rex was intentional about raising the church in the esteem of the larger community. He was also the greatest at, well, I could go on. My point in taking you on this trip down memory lane about Rex, my all-time favorite preacher, may make some more sense when I tell you that that church shrank. It shrank and it shrank. When I was there, they held discussion groups about why this was so and what we might do about it. I was frankly very naive and inexperienced in churchy matters. When it came up that Methodist preachers move about as often as military personnel, I'm sure I said right out loud, "Well, if Rex goes, I go." Rex performed the marriage ceremony 14 years ago for Paul and me, an all-time favorite memory of mine. And the violinist played Ashokan Farewell for us. Ashokan Farewell was a piece of music used in Ken Burns' Civil War. It is beautiful, and it reminds me of the familial war I lived in growing up. It is, for me, an all-time favorite piece of music. Imagine my surprise 2 years ago, the first day I came to LCUUC. Karen Haskell was playing Ashokan Farewell for us. I felt instantly at home, and for a variety of reasons that kept and keep unfolding. When we got here, LCUUC's previous part-time minister was in the process of leaving. We watched some people become unsettled, and some were clearly wondering how the church might go on with things changing so drastically. We were so new, a kind of new I had never been before. When you move to a new region, every little thing is new. My ear was not tuned to the accents I was hearing, nor the words that were being pronounced. Poblaki paving, the sign says as you drive in. My children want a Sprecher's soda. Brat, Leinenkugel, Kugel. Maybe Paul and I felt so at home here because we had been involved in two other UU congregations, and though we had not stayed very long with either, we had both agreed that UU principles are our spiritual home. We'd been a part of several congregations in our married life and not stayed very long in any. No preacher really stood out. I told Rex a long time ago that he had ruined me for other preachers. Maybe he was holding his tongue at that comment. As we have watched what's been happening here at LCUUC in the last couple of years, I have realized something new was happening to me. I see how genuinely other people feel at home here, whether they are new or old. I felt this church home would thrive in spite of a simple changing of the guard, and I understand in a much more healthy way what a preacher is really for. By the time Jim came on board, I was fully aware that it's the people that make this place, always have for 15 years made this place, the inspiring, fun, open-armed, open-minded, hard-working, caring, creative, willing, generous home that it is. And Jim, now that I'm over my selfish infatuation with my old preacher, I have room in my heart for all that Jim brings to the party. I had the idea for what I wanted to say today because of a conversation I had with some of you and Jim's friend, Jenny Corder. Jim, thank you for all your hard work in the last 15 months to help steer this ship. We needed your exact experience, your patience, your genuine appreciation for who we are, your challenge to who we can become, your leadership, your thoughtfulness, your intellect, your caring. And now I'm on the ministerial search committee. I love this place and am having great fun doing wonderful work with amazing people. I'm talking about the seven of us on the search committee, and I'm also talking about what happens among us all on any given day here at my all-time favorite church. And so if we'll open our hymns, we're going to sing number 312. Thank you.
This is a challenging Sunday. First we hear about Olympia Brown. She and I have one thing in common. Well, we have two things in common. We were both ministers, and I still am. But we also went to the same college. She a few years before I. But what a challenging person to have as part of our religious tradition. Goodness, and then Susan stands up here and tells us about Southern preachers. And I make some claim to being a Southern preacher. Not too much of the hell and brimstone variety. I guess I could work on it. But these are very strong examples of the nature of religion and ministry and church. And then finally, Mike makes a disclaimer that we have a lot of different points of view here. And I was getting ready to instruct you this morning in what your point of view ought to be. And I think I still will. But as we have freedom of the pulpit, so we have freedom of the pew. And it's up to you to decide how much of this you wish to agree with and take in. And I'm always happy to discuss it further after the service. Old Walt Whitman, when he was younger, wrote the poetry of Leaves of Grass, finishing in 1855. Whitman's eye, Whitman's mind and his heart and his soul, Whitman's pen cast a wide net across these pre-Civil War times in America. He wrote of America, he wrote of America's people, and he wrote of his place among America's people. In the second section of Leaves of Grass, A Song of Occupations, Whitman writes of the country and its presidents and other officials. We thought our Union grand and our Constitution grand. I do not say they are not grand and good, for they are. I am this day just as much in love with them as you, but I am eternally in love with you and all my fellows upon the earth. The sum of all known reverence and respect I add up to you, whoever you are. The president is up there in the White House for you, and it is not you who are here for him. The secretaries act in their bureaus for you, not you here for them. The Congress convenes every December for you. Laws, courts, the forming of states, the charters of cities, the ongoing and coming of commerce and mails, all are for you. Yes, I think we can agree with Whitman. The president is there for us, and we are not there for him. The bureau secretaries, the Congress, their enactments, the systems of government at all levels, all commerce, all are for us, the citizens. The persons, the offices, the institutions are here to serve the public, the people, you and me. You and I. The best, the greatest presidents believed that it was their honor to serve the citizens. They knew the citizens were not meant for their benefit, nor for the benefit of special interest. And whenever a president forgets that And even more important, when the people forget that, America is in trouble. So what does it mean to be presidential? Above all, I believe it is an attitude that recognizes, with Walt Whitman, that the president is up there in the White House for you. It is not you who are here for him. In the history of the United States, 44 presidencies have been served by 43 men. No woman president yet. Grover Cleveland was elected the 22nd president, was defeated in the following election, and re-elected as the 24th president. So that's why there are more presidencies than there are people who have served them. Our presidents have come from all stations of life, wealth to poverty. They have been all sizes, short to tall, thin to portly. They were all Euro-American until Barack Obama. They have been many ages. The youngest began service in their 40s, and the oldest served into their 70s. Our presidents have come from farms and towns and cities, from the Northeast, the East, the South, the Midwest, the Southwest, and the West. Most of our presidents have trained for the law, but others have been military men, farmers. There has been an engineer or two, college or university professors and presidents, ranchers and cowboys, a newspaper editor, businessmen, a couple of shopkeepers, and an actor. Our presidents have also served as senators and representatives in Washington and in state capitals. They have served as state governors and judges and vice presidents. Four of our presidents died from illness in office. Four more were assassinated in office, and there were assassination attempts on others. Fathers and sons have served as president, a father and a grandson, cousins. Two of our presidents lost the popular vote but were awarded the electoral vote. We'll see what happens this time. One was appointed vice president, then succeeded as president, but was never elected president. One of our presidents resigned in disgrace, as did his vice president. Two were impeached, but neither was convicted. With all this diversity among those who have served as president of the United States, what indeed does it mean to be presidential? This is a question that ought to promote a lively discussion and debate among the people of the United States. On this weekend, prior to the presidential election, I will invite six United States presidents to join this discussion. These six men I would nominate as possessing presidential quality of a high order. And we begin with our first president, George Washington, the father of our country, who established the norms for the office. In 1789, as he took up this new office, he established the practice of delivering an inaugural address. And he said to the first members of the House of Representatives and the Senate, "I assure myself that while you carefully avoid every alteration which might endanger the benefits of a united and effective government, or which ought to await the future lessons of experience, a reverence for the characteristic rights of free men and a regard for the public harmony will sufficiently influence your deliberations on the question how far the farmer, the rights of free men, can be more impregnably fortified on the latter, the public harmony, can be safely and advantageously promoted. Our third president, Thomas Jefferson, was the author of the Declaration of Independence and the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom. In the notes on Virginia, he wrote, subject opinion to coercion, whom will you make your inquisitors? Fallible men governed by bad passions, by private as well as public reasons. And why subject opinion to coercion? To produce uniformity? But is uniformity of opinion desirable? No more than of face or stature. Difference of opinion is advantageous to religion. Boy, is that a Unitarian Universalist statement. And then Jefferson continues, the effect of coercion has been to make one half of the world fools and the other half hypocrites. Reason and persuasion are the only practicable instruments by which men and women can be gathered into the fold of truth. James Madison was our fourth president. He was the father of the United States Constitution. He was one of the authors of the Federalist Papers, which defended this new form of government. And he was the author of the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments of our Constitution. Madison recognized the great danger to our nation represented by extremes of wealth and poverty. He wrote in the Federalist Paper number 10, the most common and durable source of faction has been the various and unequal distributions of property. Abraham Lincoln, our 16th president, held office during the Civil War. He enacted the Emancipation Proclamation. And I think it is safe to say that Lincoln was the greatest writer among our presidents, nowhere more elegant than in the Gettysburg Address. Many of us can still recite this from memory. This brief speech delivered at the 1863 dedication of a cemetery following the Battle of Gettysburg stands as the definitive statement transforming all regionalists and regionalism in this country, Virginians and Pennsylvanians and Alabamans and New Yorkers and so forth, transforming them first and foremost into Americans and Unionists. And you will know these words. It is for us, the living, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. I still find these words very moving. Theodore Roosevelt was our 26th president, and as you may recall, he was a trust buster who promoted the regulation of monopolistic corporations. He was also the chief architect of what became the United States National Park System. In 1910, he delivered a speech at Osawatomie, Kansas, dedicating a field which John Brown had formed. And he said, "At every stage and under all circumstances, the essence of the struggle is to equalize opportunity, destroy privilege, and give to the life and citizenship of every individual the highest possible value, both to himself or herself and to the Commonwealth. The citizens of the United States must effectively control the mighty commercial forces which they themselves have called into being. There can be no effective control of corporations while their political activity remains." Supreme Court. "To put an end to it will be neither a short nor an easy task, but it can be done." Well, we shall see. We are still trying to do it. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was 36th president and was the only president ever elected to four terms. He and his administration created the New Deal, the engine for economic and social recovery from the Great Depression, which initiated such public programs as Social Security and aids to families with dependent children and many other programs. Franklin Roosevelt served too during World War II in the worldwide struggle against fascism, Nazism, and imperial expansion. In 1932, Franklin Roosevelt spoke these words to the Commonwealth Club. "Recently, a careful study was made of the concentration of business in the United States. It showed that our economic life was dominated by some 600 odd corporations who control two-thirds of American industry. 10 million small businesses divided the other third. More striking still, it appeared that if the process of concentration goes on at the same rate, at the end of another century, we shall have all American industry controlled by a dozen corporations and run by perhaps 100 men. And then he adds, "But plainly, we are steering a steady course toward economic oligarchy if we are not already there." Strong words from all of these presidents about the nature of our country and the dangers that it faces. Words from presidents of all parties, nonpartisan words. Not a one of these men, Washington or Jefferson, Madison or Lincoln, Theodore or Franklin Roosevelt, none of them was without fault. I'm not nominating them for presidential sainthood, but I believe they provide examples of an attitude that respected their covenant with and their responsibility to the American people, an attitude that should be expected by everyone who serves in the office of president. And it is still true, as old Walt Whitman said, "The president is up there in the White House for you. It is not you who are there for him." Americans, you and I, we the people, citizens, the public, we and our presidents have not always remembered that this applies to all of the people all of the time. And we are still called to uphold that public promise, that civic covenant. Langston Hughes, among others, reminds us that America, America's people, and America's presidents have not yet fully fulfilled our promise and our covenant. Hughes writes, "Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. There's never been equality for me, nor freedom in this homeland of the free. Oh, let America be America again, the land that never has been yet and yet must be, the land where every man is free, the land that's mine, the poor man's, Indians, Negroes, me, who made America, whose sweat and blood, whose faith and pain, whose hands at the foundry, whose plow in the rain, must bring back our mighty dream again. Sure, call me any ugly name you choose. The steel of freedom does not stain. For those who live like leeches on the people's lives, we must take back our land again. America, oh yes, I say it plain, America never was America to me, and yet I swear this oath, America will be an ever-living seed. Its dream lies deep in the heart of me. We the people must redeem our land, the mines, the plants, the rivers, the mountains, and the endless plain. All the stretch of these great green states, and make America again." Before there can be the office of president, there must be the office of citizen. And in the United States, the most powerful of these two offices is the office of citizen, if we take it seriously. Its power is far greater than a simple vote in an election. For when it is joined with others and given a public voice, the office of citizen carries the power of example and the power of persuasion. We, the citizens, we, the people, must insist that all those who seek the honor of office, and especially the highest honor of the office of President of the United States, will meet our highest standards and respect the covenant that they have made with us. This is not a partisan issue. In this matter, we are united. In this matter, we are all Democrats, we are all Republicans, we are all independents. We are all members of alternative parties. Oh, let America be America again, the land that never has been yet and yet must be. This, my friends, is the work ahead of us in this presidential season and every season. Amen.
And now it is time for our offertory. The monthly food pantry collection is today for the Pewaukee Food Pantry. Loose cash donations will go to the food pantry. Checks can be made out to LCUUC with amounts for the food pantry, and for LCUUC, noted on the memo line or check envelope. If you have brought food contributions, please place them in the baskets in the foyer. Thank you.
Okay, Chris.
Please join me in the congregational affirmation, number 728. Blessed are those who yearn for deepening more than escape, who are not afraid to grow in spirit. Blessed are those who take seriously the bonds of community, who regularly join in celebration and learning, who come as much to minister as to be ministered unto. Blessed are those who bring their children, who invite their friends to come along, to join in fellowship, service, learning, and growth. Blessed are those who support the church and its work by their regular, sustained, and generous giving, and those of themselves no less than their money. Blessed are those who know that the church is often imperfect, yet rather than harbor feelings of anger or disappointment, bring their concerns and needs to the attention of the church leaders. Blessed are those who, when asked to serve, do it gladly, who realize that change is brought about through human meeting, and who do the work of committees to stay till the end. Blessed are those who speak their minds in meetings, who can take and give criticism, who keep alive their sense of humor. Blessed are those who know that the work of the church is the transformation of society, who have a vision of beloved community transcending the present, and who do not shrink from controversy, sacrifice, or change. Blessed are they indeed. And now, will you rise as you're willing and able to join in our closing hymn, number 115, God of Grace and God of Glory.
Courage, ears to hear and eyes to see.
to see. Before our closing words, let me just remind you of our program this afternoon at 4 o'clock on Sanctimony, Censorship, and Spin. I think it's going to be a very interesting occasion. I encourage you all to attend. As we leave this community of the Spirit, may we remember the difficult lesson that each day offers more things than we can do. Therefore, may we learn to separate that which matters most from that which matters least of all. May we do what needs to be done, postpone what does not, and be at peace with what we can be and do. Amen.